Everybody, welcome here today. For those that don't know me, I'm Joe Holland. I chair the Harness North Defence Heritage Advisory Group, and I also run the Engineer Corps Memorial Centre out at Blinton Camp. And it's our pleasure, in conjunction with the City Library, to host these monthly midday military history sessions. So today, we're going to look at the 110th anniversary of the establishment of the New Zealand Medical Corps here at Awapuni Racecourse back in 1914. I won't go into more of that detail because Andrew and his team are going to speak a little bit more on that, and also what it's like to be to do first aid in uniform over the last 110 years, and particularly the modern technology and services that they apply today. So without further ado, can I welcome Andrew and his team of medics to now entertain us.
Good afternoon, everyone. Kia ora tātou. As Joe alluded to, I'm Andrew Brooks. I'm the Executive Officer of the Deployable Health Organisation at the Joint Support Group based in Linton Camp. Welcome to the Terrace Lounge, kindly provided to us by a race group for today's military history presentation. The topic is as shown here. Shortly I'll outline the scope of the presentation, but firstly I'd just like to introduce my team. If you could just show your hands, please. So I have Major Retired Peter Jacobs, who will talk about his experiences in Vietnam. Sergeant Major Noel Swift. Staff Sergeant Stefan Gardner. Sergeant Major Matt Manning. Staff Sergeant Graham Farndon and Lance Corporal Trina Van Bisterbelt. The scope for today's presentation is as shown. Noting that there are time constraints, this will be a once-over very lightly. I'll first talk briefly about the creation of the New Zealand Medical Corps, the establishment of the medical training camp here at Awapuni Racecourse. Then we're going to run through a timeline of training of health personnel over the past 110 years. So I'm going to cover off a piece about training here during World War I, and then we'll skip through to the modern era of medic training today. I'm then going to conclude with some information about the Awapuni Medical Memorial before extending an invitation to everyone to take a short walk to go and visit the memorial itself. On the 7th of May 1908, an amendment to the Defence Regulations, gazetted as number 38-1908, saw the formation of a new corps, the New Zealand Medical Corps. The 7th of May marks the birthday of the Royal New Zealand Army Medical Corps and is today celebrated as our Corps Day. Units of the New Zealand Medical Corps were reorganised at the time and modelled along the lines of the Royal Army Medical Corps. And this saw the creation and transition of bearer companies into field ambulance units. Each of those consisted of four doctors, a quartermaster, and 46 other ranks. At the time, a nursing reserve was also established and affiliated to the Royal Army Nursing Reserve. So the strength of the medical corps is shown as it was at the time. 115 attached, 52 officers unattached, posted out to other units. And then the ranks within the field ambulances. By 1914, at the outset of World War I, the New Zealand Medical Corps had been in existence for 6 years. Awapuni Racecourse in Palmerston North was home to one of the country's largest military mobilisation camps for New Zealand Army personnel during World War I. In addition to medical corps elements, it also trained infantry, artillery and engineer personnel. A mounted field ambulance unit, which was located here at the Awapuni Racecourse predominantly to provide medical care to those other units training there, actually formed the initial training depot for the New Zealand Medical Corps. However, this unit was woefully underprepared. Their equipment was outdated and consisted of relics from the South African War, and their teaching methods were inadequate. Carver, in 1924, later wrote in reference to the training of medics for World War I that New Zealand was not, from a medical point of view, prepared for war. In 1915, a Royal Army Medical Corps officer, Colonel Robert Henderson, arrived in New Zealand to assume the appointment of Director General Medical Services for the duration of the war. As the Surgeon General, one of his first initiatives was to establish a fit-for-purpose training centre for the New Zealand Medical Corps, and a month later, the Awapuni Medical Camp was established. This camp would become the only facility in the country to train medical personnel for World War I, turning out medical reinforcements for the New Zealand Expeditionary Force. It operated from the 6th of October 1915 until February 1919, and was commanded initially by Major J. Hardy Neal, and later by Lieutenant Colonel Tracy Inglis. The Awapuni Medical Camp was born out of the need to improve medical training. Previous training in Trentham Camp was considered haphazard, with limited training and stretcher drills, searching for the wounded, and loading and unloading ambulances. Medical units and personnel were geographically dispersed around the country, and in rural New Zealand, busy doctors had little time available to devote to military training and were spread too far apart to be able to easily share knowledge and information. It was hard to make progress without qualified full-time instructors. Living conditions at the camp were also less than ideal, with very limited amenities. Staff were accommodated in the stewards' and secretaries' offices, while the trainees were quartered in the grandstand, as shown in the photos here. What I'm going to do now is we'll consider how New Zealand, the New Zealand Army and New Zealand medics are being prepared for war. The timeline that we're going to reflect on here represents the evolution of medic training over the past 110 years, from 1914 to today. We'll step through each of the periods shown, and you can see who is going to be presenting each relevant part. I'm going to highlight on the extent of some of the training, touching on some of the medical knowledge, technological advancements and innovations that have led to changes in training requirements. There were typically 350 to 400 Army medical personnel training at Awapuni Medical Camp at any given time, preparing them for various roles, for example, such as stretcher bearers and hospital ship orderlies. The medics themselves weren't able to choose which role they went into within the medical corps. This was determined by higher command, and they decided who went where. Medics had to be prepared to undertake a full raft of different duties, including acting as stretcher bearers, nurses, a sanitation engineer, a water expert, a cook, a clerk, a storeman, and a driver, to name but a few. Recruits took part in a challenging 15-week training program, which is shown on the slide here. In terms of their basic medical instruction, this taught them anatomy and physiology, how to treat wounds and medical conditions such as fractures and burns, bandaging techniques, shock, choking, cold conditions, poisoning, foreign bodies in the ear and eye, and drowning, etc. Palmerston North Hospital also played a critical role in supporting that learning. Training at the hospital, in the hospital setting, included provision of longer-term nursing care and nursing instruction on the use of surgical instruments, aseptic techniques, anaesthetics and antiseptics, administration of medicines, treatment of infectious diseases, and observation of the sick. All of this culminated in a final week of training and mobilisation. In December 1915, the first group of medics trained at Awapuni Medical Camp sailed out on the first charter of the hospital ship SS Marama. Thereafter, they left overseas at regular intervals. Learning continued during the lengthy sea voyage, with ongoing practice in stretcher drills, bandaging, and lessons on signalling, and the causes of diseases and their management. It's unclear exactly how many personnel served overseas with the New Zealand Medical Corps during World War I, but it is believed that it's approximately 385 to 430 of the 700 registered doctors in New Zealand that left the country to serve, so well over half. 550 nurses deployed and around 3,250 other ranks. An unknown number of doctors also served with the Royal Army Medical Corps. As you know, war often stimulates advances in technology and procedures, and for the Medical Corps, we're no different. In addition to that, in the intervening war years, there were significant changes in our tactics, techniques, and procedures. For example, we went from a very attritional warfare style to a more manoeuvrist style of warfare. In terms of the intervening years and what we learned from World War I and then applied during World War II are the concepts that are listed here. The triage, prioritisation of casualties for both treatment and evacuation. Shock, how we control bleeding and then how we administer blood transfusions and fluid resuscitation. The use of portable x-ray machines so that we could more closely examine and diagnose a raft of injuries to the skeletal system, but also illnesses. And then we had the discovery of penicillin and creation of antibiotic treatments. We had pain relief and injectable pain relief that could be administered to the individual on the battle space. And a raft of other things, as seen there. I'd now like to hand over to Peter. All yours, mate.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, kia ora. I am Major Retired Peter Jacobs, ex-Royal New Zealand Infantry Regiment and ex-Royal New Zealand Army Medical Corps. The Vietnam War was ongoing from 1960 to 1972. New Zealand's Rifle Company involvement was from 1965 to 1971. Medical elements were there until 1972. Medics went through rigorous training to support this war. After basic soldier training, aspiring medics completed a number of training courses. Now up on the wall. First of all, obviously the junior medical course comprised first aid, anatomy and physiology, bandaging and splinting, basic nursing, basic ambulance and stretcher training. After unit training, this was followed by an intermediate medical course which involved equipment familiarisation, including oxygen therapy training, hypothermia, really a New Zealand emphasis only, tropical medicine. Next was a health and water duties course, now known as environmental health, including a tropic exercise, twilight exercise in Fiji. More unit training and support to other units was followed by a comprehensive civilian and military hospital training. Medics were then considered trained to support and were posted to other units, such as RAPs, regimental aid posts. After a period, medics completed a senior medical course. This comprised advanced procedures of everything previously taught, including doctrinal and Geneva Convention principles. From here, medics attend a specialist radiographer, laboratory or operating theatre courses and undertook on-the-job training. Vietnam. Prior to joining Royal New Zealand Army Medical Corps early 1970, I was posted to Vietnam as a Royal New Zealand Infantry Regiment Rifleman. I was appointed the platoon medic. A platoon comprised one officer, platoon commander and 30 men plus some attached, for example, engineers. The Vietnam War highlighted the use of helicopters, both as personnel lift platforms and obviously casualties, for evacuation casualties. I will now illustrate the three levels of casualty care in Vietnam. Level one was on the ground. Take a look at that left slide. This slide shows a casualty being treated by the platoon medic. This particular incident was during Operation Overlander, 15 April 1969. Three platoon, Whiskey 2 Company, contacted a large enemy force in underground bunkers, defending an underground field hospital. This photo shows the platoon medic, me, tending to a lead scout who sustained serious bullet wounds, shoulder injuries. During this contact, the platoon sustained 5 casualties, all bullet wounds. The contact in this case was dynamic and ongoing, so I attended to casualties as they occurred. I treated the most serious 3 who were all casualty helicopter evacuated out, casualty. It is noted here that helo support was available very quickly, sometimes as quick as 20 minutes. This emphasised the golden hour, which is the time then from injury to life-saving first surgery. Level 2 casualty care was a helo arriving at an 8-field ambulance at Bung Tower. Also part of level 2 casualty care was conveyance of the casualty from the helicopter to the hospital by stretcher. This slide, next slide, shows the casualty undergoing level 3 care at 8-field ambulance in Bung Tower. Fourth level care was that received in moving casualties to Australia or New Zealand, where higher level surgery and definitive care was undertaken. That slide on the right, Royal New Zealand Navy, Royal New Zealand Army Medical Corps and Royal New Zealand Air Force medical personnel, both regular and territorial force, including surgeons, anaesthetists, radiographers and electrical mechanical engineers, were attached to Bon Son Hospital in Quinon in the Bindun province. Also, many Kiwi nurses were attached to 8-field ambulance in Bung Tower over the years. Not forgetting Kiwis attached to the Red Cross team, just to the north of Quinon. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes my presentation.
Indicates above, the situation during that period of the 80s was relatively quiet around the world. There was no major conflicts per se, and part of that was the Cold War still dragging on. But you had the likes of Bougainville and the first VGQ at the latter parts of the 1980s. At that stage when I joined, there was 4 24-hour army hospitals located in Tatker, where I first joined the military, Wairu, Lytton and Burnham. However, as the camps got smaller, the military hospitals closed and the medical training was also changed in the 90s. Medicine, all the training that I'm going to discuss shortly, they came out, whether it's 5, 10 or 15 years, when they first day certificate recognised by St John for 3 years. So there was not much in the way of recognition at that stage. The first course, similar to the area that Peter Jake was making about, they did the junior medical assistance course, which is pretty much an advanced first aid course with stretches and drills and pitching tents, etc. And basically, it was we're more on the World War II or Korean period of warfare. At that stage, TF Reserve, or reservists as they're called today, were allowed to do courses after their basic training as well. Every morning you had a quiz, and basically when you finished your course, your class was banned to medical assistants. From there on, you did 12 to 18 months on the job experience, that in your hospitals and bases. From there we moved on, after your 18 months, you did a pre-entry test, you did your intermediate clinical assistance course, and this was the big course. This is where you really got into depth with anatomy and physiology, etc. Again, quiz every morning. But you learn higher medical skills, anatomy and physiology, how to do IV injections, suturing, and other medical conditions, as well as pharmacology, what pulls lotions and potions to give. Environmental medical conditions were also taught, hypothermia, again, for New Zealand conditions, and also head exhaustion and stroke, because we did a lot of exercises and Malaysia, Singapore, and sort of islands, etc. Nursing schools were also taught back then, bed bathing for patients, and sheet changing and all those things. Again, as mentioned, courses every morning. Following on from your IMA course, you then did a 10-week civilian hospital training, and I did mine on Middleborough, the most rewarding. And then you did 6 weeks on ambulance training at Thornhill St John. After all that training, you were classed as a Band 3 medical assistant. And by this time, you would have done a couple of operational deployments, and then you were eligible to be promoted to Lance Corporal. Following on from the IMC course, or IMA course, then you did your preventive medicine course, and that was 6 weeks of study of infectious diseases and treatments. Infectious treatments also consisted of water testing, how to do mosquito control, and of the old fog, if anybody was in the military, we would see that known as being a noisy cloud-producing fogging machine, and also vermin control. You also had the sighting of and erecting of field hygiene fixtures, traditionally held at Tekapo. We had to dig deep into make washstands or soap holes for the for the cooks, showers, urines, etc. And also where to site the latrines, and they were six packs, as we called them. You sat back to back, side by side, but you did it for the privacy with the scrim around. Yeah, again, you had every quiz every morning, and to culminate in that, you went over to the Pacific Islands, and you did about 2 weeks over there, doing health surveys and general health and hygiene assistance if required. Again, after a further 18 months of on-job experience, you were classed as a Band 4 medical assistant. Following on from that, you're had about a 2 to 3 hiatus, if you like, on the job experience to get yourself further knowledge, and that comprised of the exercises in New Zealand and overseas. You were then eligible to do your junior NCO course and also a medical section commander's course. This is really pretty hard, the old med section commander's course, and then you'd be eligible for promotion to full corporal. Following up from that was your major and your final major course was your advanced medical assistance course, and that's similar to what Peter had. You had advanced medical invasive techniques, IVs again, ECGs, manual defibrillations, tubing, ET tubing, etc., as you can see there. To tidy up and to reinforce the next element of your training, you had 5 options to choose, which one you had to do. I was lucky enough I did 3, but as you can see there, you're quite rounded in your training. And these things would take about 6 to 8 weeks, if not more, whichever one you selected. After that, you were then Band 5 medical assistant, and your class is top trade. By this time, you would have been eligible for doing your CNCO clinical course to become a sergeant. And eligible for, once you take the junior health planners course, eligible for promotion to staff sergeant. And that's my presentation. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Stephen Gilder. I've been a member of the course since 14th April 1993. And I'm going to take us now through training in the 90s and discuss maybe some of the changes. So, as Smidge Swift has alluded to, we still had the same construct of 3 courses, painful but short time frame, because the main focus, especially in our junior year career at that stage, was get out into the workplace, get the experience, and get your hands on to patients, and that sort of thing. So our junior year training was that we were still medical assistants, 5 to 6 weeks, anatomy and physiology and first aid and ward cares. So the ward cares and hospital cares that we used to do in more senior courses were brought down to the junior level. Because the next 12 to 18 months we basically became orderlies and everything else within the treatment centres, where we still had a warrior, Linton, Trentham, and then you had 12 to 18 months where if you earned your stops you got to go to the next level. the first changes of menu that were going to happen over the next sort of couple of decades was the terminology for a medic. So we went from being medical assistants to medics, because I was deemed that we not only assist medical officers and nursing officers, but we actually do our own thing, especially in the field and in austere environments. So the first thing that changed was the name of the courses. So I did an intermediate medical course, or an IMC, instead of an IMA course. Again, short duration. We were taught more advanced trauma, just as Major Swift was. Something that was brought down to that level from the advanced course, with things like minor surgical procedures, suturing, IVs. We even were taught cut-downs, which is a very basic procedure, but I'm not sure if that was a learning objective or just something that my instructors were able to do, because I've never used it in my 30-odd years career. The emphasis on this level, and this is sort of looking probably the 2 years in, was we wanted to get you out onto the face and let the sharp end supporting the infantry engineers, guns, army corps, as a salt charge unit. So you do this course, you then go back to your units, then you chuck into a civilian hospital and civilian ambulance for 10 weeks, focusing especially on the hospital and the emergency department, theatre, the acute wards. The intent was to get your hands bloody, but depending on which hospital you went to, obviously that either did or didn't happen. I did my 10 weeks here at Palmerston North, and probably dealt with more drug overdoses and anything trauma wards. It was still very handy, but we don't tend to get that a lot in the back doors or extending the wall. And then we come to our advanced retraining. So we still have things like the preventive medicine course, and this sort of occurred in between these levels. Our Pacific Island trip was still a couple of weeks in Tekapo, not Fiji. And the curriculum for that course, or that training, didn't really change a lot because there hadn't been many advances as far as the military was concerned in those areas. We get the advanced medical training, so we're looking at the senior large corporal level. They sort of mid-90s they canned this, not because there wasn't a good course, but because when you think of early 90s, there was Somalia, the Middle East, there was all these lessons learned coming back out of these areas where maybe we need to actually educate the medics to a higher standard. And plus, at this stage, we still only had a first aid certificate after 3 years. So that was it. In mid-90s, it wasn't really acceptable. So the first iteration of the changes to come was called the Diploma in Emergency Medicine. It involved the five modules that are up on the screen. The Emergency Care Disaster Medicine module was really that was probably the crux of replacing the Advanced Medical Course, concentrated on exactly what it says, a lot of advanced trauma, mass casualty scenarios. And then we went into, because we've come about, we got these things called protocols. So until the mid-90s, there was really no actual, so apart from what we learned, there was no policy, no documents that said we could or couldn't do anything. We had no checks and balances apart from the nurses and medical officers that we worked for and the other medics. There was no annual competency requirements. You just had to turn up to work and do your job. This was a shock to a lot of us because now we actually had to prove we could do a job and we had to meet a criteria every year to show that we were competent to do it well. So this is what all this is about as well. A lot of us with a special module, we were able to get that recognised prior learning from our preventive medicine course, or if we've been lucky enough, well, it's not just what to do yours on the modules for you. The other benefit of this training change was that this aim to start sooner than the old advanced medical course. You've been waiting 6 or 7 years to do this training. You can pretty much go into this as a lance corporal, a junior soldier. And the result was you got better educated, better skilled medics out sooner, because obviously you go to the late 90s and you've got ST more global war, and then we head into what some of the management talk about, looking at Afghanistan going forward. So we were able to get higher educated, high skilled medics out on the ground for the sharp end quicker to work with.
Going on here, they're picking medics who did their training in different years. Guess when I did my training. I'm way too many. I joined up in 2004. So, what changed for the medic training in the 2000s? Oh well. So, we still had all the same core things as the 80s and 90s. The one thing that did change is, as we know, with sort of wars and when that sort of environment goes down the rip hole, there's a lot of advances in medical understanding, medical training. So, for us, the JMC IMC courses remained, and the diploma in military medicine was still the highest achievement available for medics. However, due to the conflicts in Afghan and Iraq, the USA started gathering analytical data on their battlefield casualties, which drew the conclusion that there were three types of people battlefield casualties. They were people that were going to die of their wounds regardless, people who die of preventable causes, and people who die of infection later. And what they found was where the medic and the medical trained infantry people on the ground can actually make the biggest impact on the casualties that are on the ground are for the preventable causes. So the people that die of potential massive hemorrhage. So if a medic can get to them and apply a tourniquet or direct pressure, it'll stop the bleeding. Simple airway obstructions were fixed by either head tilt chin lift or jaw thrust or other eye interventions such as oral pharyngeal airway, so a tube that gets put in your mouth, or a nasal one that gets ran down your nose, clearing that pipe. And fixing tension in the thorax. So if you get any injury to your chest, you've got air going in and out the easiest route here, and if we were able to plug it, it goes back out the right hole. So fixing those injuries, it's actually quite easy, so they're preventable causes that we can fix. Now, when I first started my military career, we used the acronym for dummies. It was Doctors ABC. Check for dangers, responsiveness, send for help, and then deal with your airway, breathing, circulation. Not too handy on the battlefield, looking for dangers, because you're on the battlefield, someone's shooting you, shooting at you. So, they came up with the new mnemonic, MARCH. So massive hemorrhage, airway, respiration, circulation, head, and hypothermia. The new teaching paradigm approached it from first aid and combat lifesavers. The mnemonic MARCH actually dealt with the injuries in order that they're going to kill you the quickest. So if you look at the doctor's ABC, you weren't allowed to deal with a massive hemorrhage until we got to C. And that's a whole lot of letters you've got to get through, whereas massive hemorrhage was first up. So there's no good having all that good blood on the ground when you have to deal with airway that you can fix easily. Due to the statistical data coming out of the Americans gathered in Iraq and Afghanistan, they also realised that a lot of medics themselves were becoming combat casualties when moving forward to deal with casualties. To limit the amount of exposure to enemy fire, medical interventions were limited, and when to treat was broken down into three phases, which led to the term TCCC, Tactical Combat Casualty Care, which is broken down into three steps, care under fire, tactical field care, and tactical evacuation. Basically, you only want to do certain parts of the MARCH algorithm at each point to prevent yourself or another member of your troop becoming a statistical nightmare as well, a casualty. As you can see there, a fourth phase actually bumped along a little bit later, and that was known as prolonged field care. And that is the medic's problem when the helicopter doesn't arrive, which whenever the weather is a bit poor in Afghan, they wouldn't show up. So you had to deal with those casualties for a lot longer. So that was the main driver focused on medical training for the 2000s. That's me done.
Good morning, everyone. I am Staff Sergeant Graham Plunder. I'm going to be talking about the medic training over the last decade. The last decade has seen a major fundamental shift in the New Zealand Defence Force's thinking around training and moving away from NZDF-specific run coursing to looking to external providers from the universities of New Zealand to help us train a higher quality medic. So I undergo training in 2008, and that was around about the decision point to change the training. The New Zealand Defence Force had successfully reorientated its medical training to address the threats just discussed by Sergeant Major Manning. Including basic training, the NZDF could produce a capable medic within 16 months of joining the service. And in 2009, the Chief Instructor of the Joint Services Health School conducted a nationwide roadshow to introduce a new concept for medic training across the three services. There were a number of driving factors to this change. Firstly, the Diploma in Military Medicine no longer held the same weight with its civilian counterparts as it once did. The impact of this meant that DMM could no longer be used as recognition of prior learning for people who were leaving the organisation looking to join St John's Ambulance Service. With the loss of the DMM status, many medics leaving the service cited a lack of civilian qualifications and a desire to get higher education were the key factors driving the decision. So the NZDF recognised the DMM was no longer fit for purpose and it needed to be replaced. The new generation of recruits were not driven by the desire to serve one's country. They were looking for employment which gave them purpose and provided them with qualifications that they could use after the service. The NZDF had begun downscaling its commitments in East Timor and the Solomon Islands, reducing operational deployment opportunities for medics who were joining. And then that drove the organisation's mindset to start shifting from operations to academia in an attempt to retain the personnel. And the last factor driving this change was St John's Ambulance Service had already made the decision that their paramedics would become registered health professionals. This raised the question of whether the NZDF medic would also need to become a registered health profession, and if that was the case, the training we were receiving was not suitable. So for these reasons, the NZDF tendered multiple universities to establish a new training framework for medics. The Auckland University of Technology won the tender, and in the first semester of 2010, Joint Services Health School marched in the first class of medics under the AUT scheme of training. The AUT scheme of medics would take 2.5 years of tertiary study to qualify. After their first year of study, they would receive a diploma in paramedic science, and with a further 1.5 years of study, they would receive a graduate diploma in health science, and this would make them qualified to work with St John's after service. In theory, the papers the medics were required to undertake, just on the left there at the bottom, would result in them having a superior clinical knowledge to any medics previously trained by the NZDF. The grad medics were required to complete shifts with St John's Ambulance throughout the training, and the NZDF required medics to conduct short on-the-job experience postings at operational units and defence health centres to gain real-time experience. Medics such as myself, who had completed a combination of the JMA, IMA and DMM courses, were given recognition of prior learning towards the grad dip. To gain the grad dip, we were required to complete 5 papers, which is up the top right there. The average medic would complete 1 paper per semester, and then after 2.5 years, we would also receive the grad dip, giving us that civilian qualification. The first class of 18 medics graduated from JSHS late 2012. There was no concurrent training framework between 2010 and 2012, which meant that no medics would graduate from training for a 3-year period of time, and this would become an issue down the track. As expected, the AUT scheme produced medics with superior clinical knowledge to their DMM counterparts. However, the military-specific components of the training were found to be insufficient. The first 6 months to a year of a medic's first posting out of training would consist of further coaching and mentoring before they were able to operate independently. And then this would push the overall training time frame out to 3 years or more. The AUT scheme medics had further issues, such as a high attrition rate during training, with some courses losing up to 40% of its trainees. And with the price tag of close to $200,000 per medic, losing anyone during training became unsustainable. And furthermore, providing medics with civilian qualifications did not address attrition and retention issues as it was intended, with medics at the same rates as they were before the AUT scheme was introduced. So around 2016, the Defence Health School decided, JSHS was now renamed to Defence Health School, and they decided they needed to overhaul their training to reorientate it back towards military medicine and drastically reduce the time frame it took to produce an operational medic. The changes in Defence Health Policy over the course of the AUT scheme dictated that further medic training would need to have a tertiary level academic instruction framework, as well as being orientated towards the specific needs of military medicine. Training would need to have medics usable in garrison and in operational environments as soon as possible to combat the damage of that 3 years with no trainees. So in 2017, Defence Health School terminated all AUT scheme medics under training to roll out the new iteration of medic training, which we'll go over now.
So my name is Lance Corporal Van. I joined in 2020 and I just graduated the medic program in 2023, so this is the latest program that is currently happening. So currently the medic training program is split into two phases. We've called it military medical technician and medic. It is a 2.5 year study. However, with COVID, it ended up being 3 years for most people just due to delays and lockdown and whatnot. So we have tri-service classes of Navy, Army, and Air Force. The new classes march in every 6 months with about 20 students. So currently the new training is with 2 months human anatomy, pathophysiology, and then an intro into the primary healthcare aspect. So learning all the specific tests for different systems, learning how to take consultations with different patients, and pharmacology, wound care, and specific interventions that need to be done in that space. Then we would get placed on 3 months on the job experience around different camps and bases within New Zealand, practicing on real-time patients under supervision of different medics and nurses in those areas. We would then come back to the school for 2 months of MMT operational skills, where we would learn the march sequence in its basic form with a couple of interventions and just the basic adjuncts that we would use. We would then, instead of going on to on the job experience to the different camps and bases, we were put on St. John's shifts. We did about 14 shifts as a third crew member with St. John's under EMT scope, just to unload some of the burden of putting us into different camps. Once you did all that coursing, you would graduate MMT into the medic scope. So once you got into the medic phase, it was building on those core foundational skills that we learned in the MMT phase. So we went through primary healthcare again, but with extended skills such as nasogastrix, suturing, intramuscular injections. We did our vaccinated qualifications, learning how to do urinary catheters, and just more extension of the skills for the consults and different treatment methods. Then we would go back out on the job experience, just into the camps and bases, a little bit more leeway this time, but still under medical supervision when we were there. When we then got back to the school, we would go into our medic operational skills, as we learned a lot more advanced skills during that time. So all your advanced airways, advanced pain relief methods, some advanced skills that critical care paramedics on St. John's use today, we use them now. We also did touch on a lot more prolonged field care and T4C working environments, just to cover that garrison and that operational environment that we now work in. Once you graduated From the op phase, you qualified as a full NZDF medic, and then you moved to unit location and then started covering your exercises and supporting the unit that way. So the current altered program, when I was going through, it was only a military focus. They've reintroduced the AUT program now. So now we include the papers of Diploma of Paramedic Science and a Graduate Certificate in Health Science. Where once you graduate now as a fully qualified medic, there are further opportunities to study towards the Bachelor of Paramedicine, which is another 8 to 10 papers. Currently, the medic program is under revision and will be changing again to suit the NZD.
Before I conclude, I'm just going to cover off a couple of pieces around the Awapuni Memorial. So the Awapuni Medical Memorial was officially unveiled and dedicated to members of the New Zealand Medical Corps by then Governor General Sir Charles Ferguson on the 3rd of December 1929, in the honour of the contribution and sacrifices made by the officers and men of the New Zealand Medical Corps during World War I, and it acknowledges their training here at Awapuni Racecourse. A stone plaque on the memorial begins with the Latin motto of the New Zealand Medical Corps, meaning faithful in adversity, and it reads as shown. The design of the memorial is described as follows. It will take the form of a large concrete water tank of the Ambulance Red Cross with a cairn built up in the centre with blocks of New Zealand marble, and an inscription thereon dedicating the memorial to those who have never returned. The tank will be ornamental and useful and will hold around 60,000 gallons of water, and water will run from the top of the cairn down the blocks on the marble into the tank. Well, we know that water only runs when the pump house is turned on, and we know from Joe yesterday that the water is actually double padding as a fire suppression mechanism, so they can bring in fire appliances and suck the water out of it and use it to fight fires. That's all good info. The restoration of the memorial has made an important statement in the remembrance of our fallen. The project culminated with a rededication ceremony on the 20th of October 2016 and included a formal military service. Speakers at this event included Palmerston North Mayor Grant Smith and the project lead, Lieutenant Colonel Darren Beck, who was the former commanding officer of the 2nd Health Support Battalion and the regimental colonel of the Royal New Zealand Army Medical Corps. Palmerston North remains a significant training location for NZDF health personnel, many of whom graduate from the Defence Health School down in Burnham and post to the Manawatū area, whether in an Army capacity or an Air Force capacity. But we, as a unit, also look after Navy personnel, so we have a bunch of the Navy medics that graduated out of the school also posted to. So, in conclusion, the New Zealand Medical Corps, well, I've talked about the New Zealand Medical Corps and its establishment here in the Awapuni camp, and really the purpose and function of the camp here. Then we've looked at a training continuum over time, medic training and how that's evolved, and how we go about preparing medics for war. We've gone from being effectively glorified first aiders to highly skilled, qualified and competent medical clinicians. I've talked about how we innovate and develop, and in some cases, how we reinvent the wheel. Sometimes things just keep going around and around as a week, and hopefully we learn from our mistakes, but we also work towards continuous improvement. Academia has obviously played a pretty big part in this, and so has the professionalisation of pre-hospital emergency care and the qualifications required to operate in that space. So hence you've heard that we've shifted from very much military-centred training towards a more academic model. which is great because it enables our people who train for a good 2.5 to 3 years to graduate with qualifications that they can actually use when they do eventually leave the military. A couple of things that we didn't necessarily touch on in the presentation, but which are nonetheless important elements which influence medic training are listed here. I've got change in diversity in the types of weapon systems that we see employed in the battle space. So, you know, modern day stuff, we're talking about the use of weaponized drones, we're talking about intercontinental ballistic missiles, those kinds of things. We've talked about changes in tactics from attritional based warfare that we've seen in World War I to a maneuverist approach to concepts like three block war, where potentially you can be dealing with a conventional battle in one block, in the next block you're dealing with a counterinsurgency, in the next block you're dealing with a humanitarian crisis. And we're witnessing that today with the happenings in Gaza. Research and development has clearly played a significant part in the way that we develop our training. So what we see is real-time casualty data and then the impact that that has when we extrapolate it out into evidence-based practice. And then obviously, as well, we've seen significant advances over time in medical equipment, techniques and procedures. I would like to say, and invite you all now, if you have any questions, to offer any questions. But also, afterwards, after we've done the questions, you can take a short walk across to that Alapuni Memorial and you have a chance to look at that. And finally, it wouldn't be a presentation without a famous dead guy quote, so here it is here. Failing to train, you're training to fail. So thank you again for your time today. I would like to say my thanks to the team, Peter, Noel, Steph, Matt, Graham, and Petrina. Thanks, team. Great effort. And I'd just like you to acknowledge as well, I'd like to acknowledge that we've got someone sitting down the end here. We're selling a bunch of RNZ ANC merchandise. If I can tempt you to prize your wallets out of your pockets, you might be interested in buying some of our core memorabilia to help with funding core activities and events. Thank you very much. Any questions?
We've got a couple of minutes, so I'm sure, given all of that information, there must be some questions.
Sure. You mentioned Gaza just before. It would be a horrendous place to be, but are there opportunities to do that at all?
Sorry?
I said it must be a horrendous place to be, but are there opportunities to be involved?
Yeah, are there opportunities for us to be involved?
Yeah, yes.
No, not really at this stage. We're not looking at getting engaged in that space.
No, you don't want to be overkeen.
Would you help make a decision?
Yeah, government-level decision. A training ground, an awful place to be.
Yeah. Any other? There must be some questions, sure. I know it's a fairly detailed explanation, and I guess it's something that we take ex-servicemen take for granted. But these guys have kept us alive pretty well. Have a look at Major Pedersen here. I mean, he's breathing, he's upright, he's a heartbeat. The last 50 odd years were about to put him in a display cabinet and he's with us. Thanks to the next to the medics.
I think another really interesting one to kind of just take note of is the transition out of the Vietnam era and then into the 80s. We went into this hiatus for kind of 15 or so years, and there wasn't a lot of operational activity happening. Yeah, we might have had the NZDF deployment in the Sinai, for example, as an ongoing, but it wasn't really until the first Gulf War kicked off in the early 90s, which Mike was involved in helping us train our team in CDRN bits and pieces, how to don our gas masks when the sirens went off, which was great. Following on from that into, a deployment over around close to a decade in Iraq, looking after the collection and then destruction and disposal of weapons of mass destruction, being chemical weapons predominantly. And also in that time, Operadion, which was happening up in Bosnia-Herzegovina. So we had that going on in the mid-90s. And then it wasn't really until we hit the 2000s where we were into Afghanistan. I think late 90s we had East Timor, and then into the 2000s with East Timor. We've also had Bougainville. So each of those different operating environments with their own peculiar threats to health. And those threats, when we think of and talk about those, we're looking at what is the operational context, what are the operational threats. Have we got bullets coming towards us, or is that not really an issue in this particular environment? Secondly, the environmental threats. What are the key environmental issues that are associated with operating in that particular environment? Is it a hot, dry climate? Is it a hot, wet climate? What are the so-whats that fall out of that? And then thirdly, the occupational context. So relevant to specific trade jobs and roles, there are different threats that people face.
So while all that's going on, we have keeping the peace, peacekeeping, because there is a social difference, and also demining. You know, some of us ginger beers have still got all our fingers, but when you have a look at the demining operations that have been going on ever since, for the last 30 or 40 years, or longer, you know, even though somebody may not necessarily be shooting at you, but by cracking some of those IEDs and booby traps and other nasties, you know, pick a bit of a punch.
Yeah.
Particularly if you cut the wrong wire or if you prod the wrong line. So, you know, it's... yeah.
Humanitarian assistance and disaster relief as well. So we had another big deployment of health folks by our expectations anyway, with the Indian Ocean tsunami that happened on Boxing Day in 2004. So that saw a team, two teams in fact, of 30 PERS, 30 plus PERS deploy to Banda Aceh to help with the response and recovery operations in Aceh. As you know, that was hit by a massive tsunami, which impacted all around the Indian Ocean.
I also think during the 1970s and 80s, if not earlier, a lot of the HADR activities, humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, particularly undertaken by the Foreign Affairs or the New Zealand government, or by, you know, by engineers, all around the Southwest Pacific, if not further afield. And I mean, in the early 70s, when we went to the Cook Islands, for example, the Pearl Harbor, yes, we did have a medic in our detachments, but I got sent to Middlemore Hospital for 3 weeks to do a, I don't know what the hell you call it, you know, an advanced band-aid course, because I was detachment commander, so I could bleed people or change blood or do, you know, all sorts of fancy things like that. And I mean, I know talking to Dr. Peter earlier there, you wouldn't be allowed to do that these days, but I mean, needs must. That's what we used to have to do back in the early 70s. So that was an interesting experience. Right, any final? Yeah.
Yeah, just curious, now that it's become more affordable and thus more available, that. Curious as to what your thoughts are or your experiences are, and do you guys, frontline medics, carry the Zelox impregnated dressings, for the hemostatic dressings in the plasma, like some of the others?
The EOS could talk to that.
Yeah, some of the gear that you've got, you know, particularly when you go into a combat environment. Sort of comment?
Yeah, so what Kiwis are really good at, and when they deploy with any other nation, is steal their stuff. The Americans, they went through many generations of the quick clot stuff, and we started doing this with the TCCC. So when they were learning about DAMCON getting the massive hemorrhage sorted using the tourniquets and the direct pressure, that's where that plays a part. The first generations were, like, as soon as they hit fluid, they heated up, and it was almost like cauterizing the wound. Not really where you wanted to go. You didn't really want to... One of the first rules of med is prevent the condition from worsening. What you're doing is burning these poor buggers that are already in pain. So then they started getting the impregnated gauze. It's still a little bit probably too expensive for us to have, but when we do deploy with other nations, we steal their stuff and we have it in their stuff. Yeah. So,
just hang on a minute. Sorry, we had another couple of questions over here, and then I think we're going to have to knock it on the head. Yeah.
Didn't we send 6 New Zealanders to help the UK and USA take out those people in that country that are blowing out the ships recently?
Targeting.
Yes,
yeah,
we did.
What was their job, do you know?
Oh, we can't tell you. Take me out of the back and shoot.
I don't know.
Yeah, sure. Helping in some way.
Yeah.
They're assisting.
Yeah. Thanks.
Sorry, there was one other. Oh. Yeah,
true. It's just good to see from all this presentation that change is still changing. Nothing has bloody stayed still from the time I was in. You know, every 4 or 5 years, we'll go back and revise.
Thank you very much.